Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being here with us on this Thursday afternoon. Maybe it's Thursday evening, maybe even Friday morning where you are and wherever you are. We're very, very grateful to get to spend this time with you. Thanks so much for spending the time with us. We got a great show. We really do. And it's a little bit of a departure for a Thursday, a special show, the first hour. Second hour, we'll do open forum with Jimmy Akin. So those of you who have to get your weekly open forum Jimmy Akin fix in, you're going to get it in the second hour. First hour, we're going to talk a bit about sacred architecture. We're going to talk about the architecture of our churches and our sacred spaces in the Catholic world and in the wider world. Are we doing well? Are we doing poorly? Particularly, are there some positive trends we can point to and maybe even foster those positive trends? If you want to call and ask about that, maybe you're considering doing some things at your parish. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. And you get to talk with one of the finest architects now working, Duncan Strike from Notre Dame University. Thank you, Duncan, for being here with us.
What do you mean, finest architects? I'm just a little professor of architecture.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to alarm you or upset you by with that. Around here, a very popular building is one that you made. It's called the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and it's a beautiful work. And we've gotten to speak with you about that before, but it's. Okay, let's. I guess the question that I want to ask you is the beauty of that building, which has a certain kind of traditional quality to it, is it a beauty that we're rediscovering, or are we still hopelessly lost when it comes to the building of our churches?
Oh, I like that question, Cy.
Okay.
Yes.
It took me long enough to get it out. I'm glad you like it.
No, I like it a lot because it is rediscovering, and I think of it a little bit like tearing down the walls of a city. We did that for 50, 80 years. Now we're rebuilding the walls, and we're relearning how to do sacred architecture and sacred art. And it's not easy, because we forgot for 50 years, but it is happening, and it seems like that's what the faithful want.
It certainly does seem like that's what the faithful want. There's a very common thing that we will hear from people is, why don't our churches look like churches, or why can't I have a church that looks like a church? And so, I think that's a shorthand for something. What do you think it's a shorthand for? What is it that people are looking for?
Yeah, Catholics have a liturgical sense. They have a sacramental sense. And even if they're not people that focus on art or architecture, they can tell. And it may be their house, it may be the office, could be one way. But when it comes to it's the house of God, maybe it should be something bigger and better.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there's not a willingness to settle, maybe, in the
right
way that there
I
was.
I think that's the key, and that's why the Catholics are the leaders in traditional architecture today in churches. The Protestants generally have given up that interest and have become very focused on other things, which may be good, but the Catholics still have that incarnational sense that we're celebrating a liturgy, and we're celebrating God. And so if it's God's house, it should be beautiful. If it's just our house, we can make it functional.
Right, right. Again, the number 888-318-7884. We're talking about positive trends in sacred architecture with Duncan Strike from Notre Dame University. Certainly, there are branches of Christianity, and it does seem to me that what's often called non-denominational churches, sometimes you hear the word megachurch, there really is almost seems like a self-conscious rejection of a beautiful building,
yes,
that the building is entirely functional.
Yes.
I'm thinking of the TV preacher that you see every Sunday. He's probably the biggest preacher in America right now, and it's a basketball arena.
Yes,
his church is a basketball arena that was converted, and go, converted? Doesn't look very converted.
No.
It just looks the same as it looked.
Right.
I'm thinking of here in Southern California, we have lots of the Calvary Chapel.
Yes.
And not saying anything against Calvary Chapel people, greatest people you'll ever meet. You'd be so happy when they're your neighbor.
Yes.
But those are really almost aggressively not beautiful buildings.
That's right.
Very utilitarian.
And unfortunately, we Catholics accepted that or bought into that for 50, 60 years. I think mainly because our church is very hierarchical, and the hierarchy thought that to be modern, they needed to embrace minimalism, and they did. And after 50 years, people said, oh, we don't really like this. It didn't turn out very well. Let's tear those down. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing a resurgence of love and appreciation for tradition.
And I think that will then make us distinctive in a way, too, that our distinctiveness as Catholics, because another thing that is very, very common among Christians around the world, even among Catholics, is, well, you know, it doesn't matter so much what church you worship in. It's that we all love Jesus.
Well, yes.
It does actually matter what church that you worship in.
Yes. And if there's many things that go into Catholicism or Christianity, but insofar as liturgy can help us, it should. Insofar as music can help us to worship God, it should. And insofar as architecture, which is probably the biggest outlay of funds that we make, and it's a very permanent investment, it should. It should help us in our faith. It should help us in our catechism. It should help us in our evangelism. And we haven't been doing that for 50 years. We're starting to do that again.
888-318-7884. So the building is for, certainly there's, it has a function for us as the Catholic community. There are these things that we do, and it should be this beautiful place to do those sacred things. But it also has a purpose beyond us. And so what it looks like in the neighborhood is important as well.
Yes, I love that. I love that our neighborliness in our buildings can speak of and should speak of transcendence. It should say, this is a place that's other. It's not just a normal shopping center or office building like many of the megachurches think of, but it's something sacred, something that you have to actually dress up to go to be quiet to go into. There's a sense of the holy because it's God's house.
Calls are coming in, but there are still a couple lines open. 888-318-7884 is actually something that lots of people love to talk with us about. And so now we finally have somebody here qualified to really answer your questions. If you want to talk about sacred architecture, 888-318-7884. You mentioned music. I was going to make the joke that we were going to do a positive trends in sacred music show, but we couldn't find any. But that's not really true either. There are
No. There
in music as well. There's I think most people would think of Avril Peart and his magnificent music. It really does say there's the possibility of recovery.
Yes.
But it's not just an act of recovery, is it? Like when you think of his music, it's also an act of doing something that even Mozart didn't do. It never was done before. So is that also true in sacred architecture?
And I think that's what all artists desire to do, but it can only be, I can really only do something new that's beautiful and harmonious and true if I know the tradition very well. And if I don't know the tradition very well, I'll do something new looking and it won't be. It'll fall flat on its face. It will be go out of style. So that's the one caveat. But all the great artists and music composers have done that. They've given us something new that can be fully embrace the tradition. And that's what we have to relearn.
So it's almost a magic that you have to do of just gathering strands mm-hmm. from a past. And not just saying, here's those same old things again, but making something out of them that's beautiful for this moment, this place, these people.
Yes, definitely. And so the great buildings that are being built today and that have been built in the past are really a collaboration with many people, but especially the pastor or the bishop who has the vision for that. Something
right.
traditional, but something you could say unique or beautiful. And the architect who wants to do the same thing. And working together, they can do it. Architect can't do it on his own. The bishop or the priest cannot do it on their own. It needs to be a collaboration.
888-318-7884. We have to take our first break. We have lots of folks on the line to talk with our guest, Duncan Stroig. When we come back, I want to ask you about just a little bit about what you see as far as the art that goes into our churches, not just the church structure itself, but the art that goes into it. And then we'll let our callers have at you. How's that?
Great. Thank you, Si.
All right. Right back with more Duncan Stroig on Sacred Architecture on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Faith is a precious gift from God. As the largest religious media network in the world, EWTN has an important role in educating others about our Catholic faith and spreading the good news of salvation. We invite you to explore our numerous pages of historical faith documents, prayers, teachings, and other current issues in Catholicism today. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It really is a great privilege to have Duncan Stroig here with us, one of the leaders among, and that, but certainly not the lone voice among those who would like to see a church look like a church, not in some trite or sentimental way, but that churches really express beauty. And that churches really mean something to the community that celebrates there. You're welcome to call with your questions, 888-318-7884. We're nothing if not demanding when you come around this building. So we're making you work an hour now after you just worked an hour with us before recording a focus program. But between the two, your wife Ruth was mentioning, and I wanted to ask you on air about artists, those who are doing, you know, we just so people know that the focus episode that we recorded earlier that'll come out in a few weeks was about St. Peter's in Rome.
Yes.
Well, St. Peter's is maybe the most magnificent building on earth,
yes.
But it's also a place where, you know, foot by foot, inch by inch in some places, you're encountering some of the greatest artworks
yes.
in the history of the world. So what about art in our churches?
Yes, and I like your point about St. Peter's because our goal as Catholics, whatever our budget is, whether it's $2 million or $10 million, $50 million or $100 million, it should be excellence. And it should be also to foster the arts and so to hire quality architects and artists, not necessarily secular people, but people in the tradition, and to promote that the church could again be the patroness of the arts as she was before,
right.
Leading the way and letting the secular world catch up to us instead of us trying to follow the coattails of the secular world, which is what we've been doing for the last 70 years.
Are there good artists doing sacred art now? Are there people who you'd say, yeah, I'd trust you to that person to go?
Definitely, yes. Yeah. And we, as architects, we try to only use original art in our projects. And so you mentioned the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Wisconsin. Everything is original art, sculpture. It's actually a little bit of a museum of sacred art. That is, we have probably 20 different artists working there, sculptors and painters and mosaics. And I do believe in all of the mediums, you know, mosaic and bas-relief and fresco painting. And it's all good. We have so a couple of people that I really rely on a lot is our Tony Visco in Philadelphia, who is a great mentor and teacher of Catholic artists, and he has a school there. He has a friend in Florence, Cody Swanson, who's a sculptor and is part of the Sacred Art School in Florence, Italy. He's an American. There's a wonderful Spanish painter that we did a recent Jesuit chapel in Tampa with Raul Berzosa, and he really paints in a Baroque Spanish way that was perfect for the Jesuits. And he's doing, right now he's doing the first new traditional church in Guatemala. He's doing the paintings
Wonderful.
There. We've worked with Leonard Porter out of New York and numerous other painters and sculptors. The other thing I want to say is there's a lot of historic stained glass on the market that you can get for a good price, but you usually have to restore it and you have to cut it down. Sometimes you could be damaging the original intent of the art. And it may not be exactly what you want. So we've had a lot of great success doing new stained glass. I say a lot of success. We've had some success, including in Tampa, some of the largest modern recent stained glass windows in the country, with Conrad Schmidt out of Milwaukee. And so I think there's a lot of good people out there, but you have to, in hiring these people or hiring the right people, then you also need to keep the bar high. That means spending money. So I believe in not, if you have to decide quantity or quality, I'd rather go with quality. I'd rather have less art in my church and have it really high quality. I'd rather have a few nice, beautiful materials than put medium materials throughout it. So we always do marble at the high altar. We make the tabernacle out of bronze or marble. We don't go cheap on the important stuff. If we have to go cheap on the bathrooms and the foyer, it's fine. It's not a problem. The front door needs to be expensive because everybody sees it and walks through there. And that's another place where maybe you have a statue of the titular, the saint that the church is named after, or some inscription over the front door or what have you.
Yeah.
So I think we need the church to become a patroness of the arts again.
This is something that I think Catholics are out of the habit of, because in America there's plenty of very wealthy Catholics. We're not short of wealthy Catholics.
No.
So I do want to get to the calls, but this is really important to me, so I want to ask you. So I'm a wealthy Catholic who says, you know what, I'd like to be like some of those Renaissance Florentine Catholics, and I'd like to be a patron of an artist or of art. How would they go about doing it? What would they do?
I love that idea. And really, most of the great churches of the world, the side chapels or the high altar, were usually paid for by one family. And you would have the right to have Mass said there for your family and maybe even be buried there. So there's a real incentive to do it well. Sometimes they could have say over the artist. Sometimes they couldn't. Maybe the community, the Franciscans or the Jesuits, said, no, this is going to be a chapel to the Immaculate Conception. That's what we're going to do. And you would pay for that or not. So today, I think there's a lot of room for patrons to say, I want to be involved. And if you're interested in a particular part of the church, to donate to that and to participate in that, even participate in seeing as the artist unfolds the designs for the altarpiece or the statuary or the fresco on the ceiling, and to be part of that. And that's very exciting, actually, for an architect to have that relationship with the client. Oh, yeah. That's what makes great art. The modern artist likes to create art and then put it in a gallery and sell it. The classical artist likes to meet the client and they ask them to do something for them, and then you work together to come up with the right story that would be appropriate for your chapel or your church or your house or whatever.
You can see how that's so much more Catholic than modern. The Catholic way of collaboration, of community. We do these things together.
Yeah, and it means a little bit of humility on the artist's side, but believe me, this is how Michelangelo did everything. Everything he did had to be done for a patron. He didn't just go and create Jesus dead in his mother's arms and then sell it. No, he had a cardinal who asked him to do that.
And he was good? He was a good artist?
He was pretty good.
Okay. All right. Just confirming that with you. Let's go to St. Augustine, Florida, watching on YouTube. Gregory, you're starting us off. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Duncan Stroik.
Hey, good evening. I was calling. I was fascinated when they turned the old Crystal Cathedral out in Grove Park, California, into a glorious cathedral now. And I was just wondering what type of transformations had to be made to make that space into a Catholic space.
Oh, yeah. That's now Christ Cathedral for the Catholic Diocese of Orange. It used to be Fuller, right? It was Reverend... now I'm forgetting. I'm forgetting the
Schuller.
Schuller. Yeah, right. Who you used to see on TV all the time, and he was a great figure here in Southern California. But the church was sold, and the property was sold, and now it's becoming. I'm not sure if they're done with it yet, but it's becoming Christ Cathedral for the Diocese of Orange. Have you seen it? Do you know what they changed?
I have not seen it in person. I think it was a real challenge because that building is a glass building inspired by let's say, glass buildings, greenhouse-type buildings, and it had a lot of very innovative things at the time, very much seating on multiple balconies and different views, and to try to give it a strong direction or a directionality was something they tried to do. There is a sanctuary created. There was a stage before. There is more of a directionality to it. And, of course, you know, a fundamental thing for a Catholic church is that there's a consecrated altar. The altar is Christ, should be out of stone. We have the bodies of the saints under it or within it, the relics. And then because of that altar and that which is Christ, we have him linger with us in his real presence in the Blessed Sacrament, and so we have a tabernacle. Those are kind of the fundamental things. Whenever you turn a building into a church or whenever you build a building for a church, same concept, it needs to be blessed and consecrated, and the walls are anointed. And it's a little bit like baptizing a building or confirming a building all at once. And we do the same things to whether it's a renovation or a new building.
I know that the focal point was that was where the preacher would preach, and then right behind him, a gigantic organ.
Yes.
And in a Catholic church, it really wouldn't be appropriate to have the organ be the focal point. So I don't know where they moved it, but I know they moved it.
Yeah, and they've kept the organs, and that was one of the things that really drew them to it, to that building. But it was a very hard project to do, and I know that a number of architects were interviewed about it, and it's not everyone is pleased with the design. But again, it was a hard project to turn a modernist Protestant megachurch. It's really one of the early megachurches.
Yeah, right.
Really, we're talking about megachurches today. It's really an early Protestant megachurch. Turn that into a Catholic cathedral. It's not a normal thing to do.
No, one of the things that Reverend Schuller pioneered was the drive-in church. Mm. And so you can still, the parking lot is still shaped like a drive-in.
Yes.
over on one side of the building. And it's like a drive-in movie theater.
Yes.
Where they used to have the little speaker that you would hang on the window
right.
of your car.
And I think he was laughing during COVID because...
Because then everyone needed it.
Even the Catholics were doing drive-in masses.
That's
yeah.
probably
he
right.
was just really loving it.
Gregory, thanks. I'm going to keep moving because there's lots of folks that'd like to talk with our guest, Duncan Stroik. Let's go to Kurt in Boston, listening on the Station of the Cross. Kurt, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Duncan Stroik.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I was a Protestant, and when I came into the Catholic Church, of course, being a Protestant, I didn't know really what was going on. So when I would go into the church, I wanted to learn more because I'd see the Stations of the Cross and the way everything is set up. And I was Episcopalian. Now, it's ironic because this kind of goes with the art, you know, when you have the sacrifice of the Mass and then you had the worship service of Episcopalianism, it tried to imitate the Mass. Well, in reality, as I learned, you know, you have a consecration, you have a valid priest. And I think all these things, the center point of the church has to be the main altar. It has to be Christ. And I think the art should represent that. And I've noticed, well, I came into the church in the early 90s, but when I go to the traditional Latin Mass, I'm noticing how, wow, now this is Catholic. And I say that because I could see the total break from Protestantism because all seven sacraments are visible. And I think the art should represent that in a very beautiful form because it draws the attention from the as you enter the church to the altar because it's all about the sacrifice of the Mass.
Kurt, I'm going to let Duncan respond to that because it's extraordinary what Kurt's saying.
I love what you're saying, Kurt. And so a couple of things I'm thinking about. One is the building itself teaches and the building catechizes, at least in your experience. And I've heard that from many people that a beautiful Catholic church can really draw them. There's something more there. I remember my wife saying, this has something here that I didn't find in other Protestant churches, and that it was the real presence. And so the building should teach, the art should inspire, and I think that's and it points, you're saying, points to the sacrifice of the Mass, points to the altar, And that is one of the, I say there's 5 points of sacred architecture. One of them is directionality. And directionality means that it, there's an ending or a focus. It needs a focus, and that is Christ in the altar, in the Blessed Sacrament. In he's many places, but it's a focus on Christ, and that's why we go.
Kurt, it seems like you found in an experiential way what as an architect, Duncan Stroik has kind of elaborated in language. But that makes sense to you, that sense of directionality?
Well, yes. I mean, the thing is you don't want to have a horizontal plane. You want to have something that lifts your whole being upward.
Did you take his class at Notre Dame? Kurt, did you take Duncan Stroik's class at Notre Dame? You sound like him.
No. I did not take, no. I had to learn the faith. My wife taught me the Hail Mary. But, I mean, I'm telling you, you know, everything is transcendent. I mean, we were made to get to heaven. Everything has to point upward.
Kurt, thank you so much. Perfect to head into the break with those words. We'll be right back with lots more questions for Duncan Stroik. We're talking about positive trends in sacred architecture in the Catholic Church.
Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Hi, this is Janet Williams. You don't have to be a woman to enjoy Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. What a great Thursday we're having. Second hour, Jimmy will be here for, we'll do open forum. So if you've got an open forum question, I know we had an 8-year-old young lady called yesterday and we told her to call back today. So I hope she'll call. You're going, if you're 8 years old, you're going to the front of the line if you called yesterday. We wanted to make sure we got to your call. But this hour, we have the great privilege of talking with Duncan Stroik, who made a terrible mistake. He agreed to come out to the West Coast to do a talk for Chris Check. And if you do that, then you got to do 20 other things as well. One of them is the live radio program.
Yeah. So what a pleasure.
You won't make that mistake again.
Well, you probably will never have me on here again, but it's fine. I'm enjoying
it. That's not true. lots of folks with questions. Let's see who else we got. We're talking about sacred architecture, by the way. There are two lines open and probably time to get to you if you want to call with your question. 888-318-7884. But let's go to the lines we have here. Ralph in Iowa, listening on 105.3 FM. Thank you for your call, Ralph. Go ahead with your question for Duncan Stroik.
Okay, Duncan, you're probably familiar with the concept in certain artistries. I know in American Indian artistry, they put flaws in their tapestries and stuff like that, and there's a significance to it. And I'm not so sure in artistry in a Catholic church. We have a church 150 years old or something like that. It's a beautiful in the dome, in the above the altar in the sanctuary. There's the seven sacraments displayed, and I've looked through that stained glass windows intensely, and I found the flaw in that church in the stained glass window, and it happens to be right next to the middle one, which is the Eucharist.
Yeah.
And it's quite obvious when you see it. And I mean, it's the only piece of stained glass that is
imperfect,
turned around, imperfect.
Okay.
And I give tours of the church, and people ask me that, and I says, well, I think I know why it is, but I really don't know why that's put in there, especially maybe in a church.
All right, let's ask Duncan.
What's the mistake, Ralph, or the flaw?
It's a chalice, basically, and it says above it, you know, Eucharist and stuff. And then the trim around it, on the outside edge, there are leaves that curve one direction, and that panel on the opposite side of it is totally upside down, and you can look at every stained glass window in that church and look at the borders and examine them, and every one is perfectly symmetrical, left to right. And this one, one's upside down. I don't think the guy was having a beer for lunch, you know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. All right.
So my sense is that we do have flaws in our churches, and I've met people that have flaws in their life. I don't have any, but
congratulations on that.
Yeah, I think it is kind of natural that we have flaws and we make mistakes, but the goal is to, in our architecture and our art and our stained glass, is to reflect, be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. As much as possible, I think we're heading for perfection. We're not going to make it in this world, but we're trying to. And so you're right. Those are the kind of things that bother you and some of your friends. They bug me immensely when I see those things. But it is true that we have limitations, and our art and architecture sometimes show that. I don't think it's intentional, though. I think it's just we sometimes flip the stained glass backwards or forget to do it.
Ralph, thanks. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very, very much. We're going to go to Columbia, South Carolina now. Kirk in Columbia, listening on St. Peter's Radio. Go ahead, Kirk, with your question for Duncan Stroik.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. Thank you. So we have a real opportunity here. We got a plot of land to start from scratch on an existing parish. It's a university parish, Thomas More. And we don't want to mess it up. It's right, has an opportunity to be a really visible witness to the university. And the, kind of some general tips, maybe. For instance, the name is Thomas More. How do you integrate that into the architecture? Should it be tied to his time and architecture's time? And then another general question, what about naming rights and these plaques and so forth? How do you approach that, it seems? And then how do you pick a good architect that understands all this?
Wonderful, Kirk. Thank you.
Well, I agree with your last point. Very important that you find a good architect, a Catholic architect, to help you do this, and they will help guide you on some of this. Very exciting project. I'm a professor. I love education. I love Thomas More. He's a great patron saint of lawyers and of students, so it's a great name for a chapel at a college. And so my hat's off to you. A couple of quick things. If it's a church dedicated to Thomas More and for college, why not think about the iconography, the imagery, as being specific to students and academics and Thomas More, and think about his life and how that could be portrayed. St. Charles Borromeo, the great Bishop of Milan in the Renaissance, said you should always have a statue of the titular, the name, the saint that the church is named after. And I always prefer to have that image in the sanctuary, the main image. So when you go into Thomas More, it's different than going to the Church of St. Luke or to St. Mary's. And so I think there should be a prominent image of Thomas More right in the sanctuary behind the altar. That's what I would do, some kind of... I would think, and we've done a number of university chapels, this is a great opportunity to think about how you speak to students, how you speak to students today, and what kind of models that you give them. And that can be very helpful to think about. Maybe there are some great academic saints that you want to emphasize, or different vocations that you want to emphasize, different states in life that students in Columbia should be thinking about as they do that. And so it's a very exciting project, and I'm encouraging you to do the standard church that everybody else does. No, I want you to think about doing something very specific for Thomas More and for Columbia.
Very good. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you,
what
sir.
Do you think about these plaques where people, they tend to get kind of out of control, honestly, and detract from the, I'm not sure really if the church has a policy on naming plaques. And
yeah, we need to ask Pope Francis for a new policy on that. No, we've done it all different ways. I don't have strong opinions. I do like putting the plaque in the lobby, in the narthex, where you can label all the people who have donated. But we've also done names, small brass nameplates throughout the church, as long as they're kind of small and surreptitious. I think it's kind of nice. I have to admit, on the old stained glass windows, sometimes, church that I go to, St. Monica's, I walk by the stained glass and I see this family and that family donated the stained glass 100 years ago. I think about that family. And that was one of the reasons to put their names there, is that later generations would pray for them. So that works. And if it's done in good taste, I think that could be a good way for us to be connected to our forebears, our forefathers.
Well, thank you very much. Y'all have a good evening, gentlemen.
All right. God bless you and good luck while you undertake that important work. I'm going to keep going here because we got lots and lots of folks on the line. I appreciate that Kirk is, you know, undertaking this effort to build a church and thinking in these terms, like how much should we worry about the namesake of the church, the patron of the church, Thomas More, and how much should we worry about it being a witness to the community? That's really important. I wonder if many churches think about that.
Especially in a college town, that would be likely to have a bigger impact.
Let's go to Joan, listening in Virginia on EWTN Channel 130 Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Joan, we're delighted to have you. Go ahead with your question for Duncan Stroik.
Well, I was going to say, I'm not 8 years old, but I'm old, so I appreciate you taking my call.
Okay.
I have a question about the golden meme. I have read that, I don't know if you call it dimensions, but that's been used in the creation of church buildings or sacred architecture. I'm really curious about it because it's supposed to mimic what's in nature. And so I'd like to know more about that, and is it still being used? And the second part of my question is, if it is used, is it feasible to, like, build a small space, a small private space, like, say, for instance, on my farm, where I could use those dimensions?
Sure. Well, you certainly could do that. And, of course, the golden mean is a proportional system, and it can be used in any dimensions you want. And this, it's hard to describe, but basically the golden mean is if you take a square and you divide it into half, and then you take a compass and you take that half of the square and create an arc, you get a bigger rectangle. And the beauty of it is that rectangle, that you, if you add a square to it, then it makes a bigger golden section. If you add a square to that, you get a bigger golden section. So it has this kind of spiraling idea that is very exciting to people and to architects. It is somewhere between a 2-3 proportion and a 3-4, somewhere in between there. Most people cannot distinguish the golden section proportion with a 2-3. So I'm a bit of a skeptic. I say, well, it's another nice rectangle. 2-3 is a good rectangle. 3-4 is a nice rectangle. You say golden section or golden mean is better. Okay, that's fine. But that's I don't know if we can prove that. Is it still being used? modernist architects gave up a lot of things in the 20th century, and what they replaced it with, they gave up ornament, they gave up sculpture, they gave up the figure, they gave up transcendence, they gave up a lot of things. One of the things they replaced it with was the golden mean. So we've really promoted the golden mean during modernism. It's one of the few things you can hang your hat on with modernism. So there's a lot of interest in architects with the golden mean. I happen to be a skeptic about it. Again, it's a two to three, it's somewhere between a 2-3 proportion, right? 2 squares by 3 squares and 3-4. And you could certainly build that at your property and see what you think.
Okay, Joan?
Is there some place where I can see it visually? Is there a book resource or something that I could take a look at?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff online about the golden section and golden mean. And there's, I would say, if you read enough of it, you'll say, this is very New Agey, and it's all over the place. And one person will say that it's the great temple of the Parthenon is golden section. Somebody else will say it's some other proportion. It's very hard to prove that a particular proportion is used in a particular building unless we can find the drawings of the architect and he said that that's what he used. So it's very hard to go back and say at the Parthenon or the Pantheon or St. Peter's that they use these proportions unless you can have a drawing where you can find that proportion inscribed. And you really can't find those proportions used in the Renaissance or the Baroque. It's a fairly recent, I don't want to say that the ancients didn't use it, but certainly we don't find it being clearly used until the 19th, basically the 19th and 20th century.
Joan, we got to go to our break. So thank you very, very much for the call. We're talking about positive trends in sacred architecture with Duncan Stroik of Notre Dame, Duncan Stroik of Notre Dame University. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more calls.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hey, this is Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. I'll be delving into the fascinating world of miracles and taking you on a hunt that explores the greatest mysteries and marvels of the Catholic Church. I'll be examining what constitutes a miracle, how miracles are investigated and approved, and the role they play in the lives of the faithful. We'll look at the miracles of the Gospels and early Christianity, considering the claims of the miraculous in our own modern age.
The Miracle Hunter, Saturday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. What a fun and lively conversation. And I do think it reflects the fact that, as you were saying at the beginning, our guest, by the way, Duncan Stroik, architect and professor of architecture at Notre Dame University, there is an awakening among the Catholic people, certainly, and maybe among Christian people more generally, of these buildings matter, this idea that they should be functional first and we'll worry about all that non-essential stuff like beauty later is wrong. It's just wrong. And I don't think we all have the language to say what needs to be done, but we all intuit that something needs to be done.
Yeah, good term, non-essential, good COVID term.
Yeah, right.
If you're non-essential, don't go to work. If you're non-essential,
yeah.
If the art and architecture is non-essential, don't worry about it.
Well, you said something to me earlier that I think bears repeating, if you wouldn't mind, about you said liturgy is wasteful. Liturgy is inefficient, is what you said.
Yeah. Yeah, to do things well, if you want to take your girlfriend out for dinner, you waste a lot of time. You don't just eat fast. You want to make it meaningful. And if you're going to ask her something important or you're going to do something for someone important, you make it take even longer. And the liturgy is the ultimate feast and the ultimate sacrifice, and we honor that. Can the architecture help to support that in the liturgy? And a liturgical architecture supports the liturgy, whether it's a half an hour daily mass or whether it's a 2-hour Easter vigil. And I believe that if you are going to a church and you go back to it multiple times, it needs to be able to, the building itself needs to continue to speak to you.
Yes.
Because you keep going back. So it's a little bit of a sermon in stone. The building and the artwork is a sermon in stone. Now, there could be a sermon, a daily sermon or weekly sermon that brings the scriptures alive. But the sermon in stone needs to bring truths alive that are timeless, that you can hear each time that you go.
Sonia in Atlanta, Georgia is next. Sonia, are you listening on The Quest?
Hello?
Oh, I saw you. Go ahead with your question. I'm sorry. Go ahead. I thought you might be listening on The Quest radio station.
I am listening on The Quest radio station.
Oh, that's good, because we love that radio station. All right, go ahead, Sonia, with your question for Duncan.
Thank you so much. I'm an architect. I studied at Catholic University of America a long time ago, and I just love this topic. I just want to say thank you. I'm loving the discussion, and I wanted to. My favorite class back in school was Sacred Space. It was a joint theology and architecture course, and I'd love to know where I can read more about it. Have you written any books?
That's great. It's great to hear from an architect and somebody passionate about sacred space and sacred architecture. Yes, and I have a lot of friends at Catholic U, so I'm glad to hear about that. So two things that I'd encourage you to consider, and I'd be happy to send you a copy. We publish a magazine called, I forget what the title is, Sacred Architecture. And we write about contemporary issues, historical issues, liturgical issues, and it comes out twice a year, Sacred Architecture. Look at that, sacredarchitecture.org. If you can find my email address, just send me a note and I'll send you a free copy. And then there's lots of good books out there. There's some nice books by Dennis McNamara, Michael Rose, lots and lots of smart people, smarter than me. But I needed to make a lot of money, so I wrote one called The Church Building. I'm kidding. The Church Building is a Sacred Place. The Church Building is a Sacred Place. And that has kind of my theory all boiled down into one book. But the key is, really, it has lots of great images of historic and contemporary churches that are trying to exude the 5 points of architecture.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And I will email you, and I will look for your book. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and, simply, thank you. Yeah, and simply for anybody listening, stroik@stroik.com if you want to email me, and if anybody wants a free copy of the magazine.
All right, Sonia, you got something for you got everybody a free gift. It was like an Oprah Winfrey show right now. You're just giving stuff.
A free car.
You get Sacred Architecture. Sacred Architecture.
Free tabernacle.
Free tabernacle.
Sure.
Wow.
Out of the best materials. Plastic. No.
Katie in Columbia, South Dakota, also listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Katie, go ahead with your question for Duncan Stroik.
I was kind of curious whether you've been following the renovations for Notre Dame in France after the fire. So are they staying true to the original design? And I know it's owned by France itself and not the church. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct.
Yes, it was stolen by France. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. That's not what you said. I beg your pardon.
No, that's a great question. And when I was reading it here online, I was wondering if you were asking me about renovations at where I come from, which is the University of Notre Dame, Fighting Irish, but you're asking about Notre Dame in Paris, they stole their name from us. No, we, Our Lady. So, it was a great debate after that terrible fire a couple of years ago, and the modernist leadership, President Macron and some of the other elites of France, wanted to rebuild the great cathedral of Paris and one of the great cathedrals of the world and put a modernist, modern mark, secular mark, I believe also, you know, make it out of steel, make it out of titanium, put some restaurants on the roof, put a swimming pool on the roof, anything that would confront or deny or abrogate the greatness of this church dedicated to the Virgin. So what's interesting is they're in control and they have control of the money, but there are a few people speaking up against it, including the architect of Notre Dame, French architect, who's in charge of Notre Dame and other historic buildings, and he said they should rebuild it the way it was, exactly the way it was, which is really the spire, which fell into the building which was basically a 19th century spire. But they're going to, the people rose up. The people rose up, and the French people of faith, of no faith, of agnostics, they want Notre Dame to be returned to the way it was, which isn't from 1250, but it's actually from, 1840. They want it to be returned to 1840 because 1840 was beautiful, and it was. And it, so I'm very happy that they're going to do it. Now, that's not an easy task, so we're going to be covering it in our magazine. And if you're really interested in the subject, please send me a note, because we did a whole issue in Sacred Architecture on Notre Dame in Paris and all the debates and all the controversy. And it's very exciting that they've listened, in this case, listened to the popular vote.
All right, Katie.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. I'm really glad you asked the question, because I had no idea that they were thinking about putting a swimming pool on top of a
yeah. It would be better. I guess better heated building. In the winter or something. I don't know. Makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, but it's funny because sometimes the wisdom of the common person is much greater.
Than thank God.
The president of France. Yeah. Come on. But is it really hard? It's very complicated to. Would they use, for example, you said they want to use steel and all that, but would you have to use steel in a hidden way to rebuild this building, or could you build it in the materials that it was built in?
Well, that will be very interesting, what they're going to do, because Viollet-le-Duc, who rebuilt, Notre Dame was, you could say, had been renovated over the centuries, but the key was the French Revolution and afterwards really did a lot of destruction. They went and cut off all the heads of the statues on the outside. They destroyed some of the sanctuary. They painted over things. And Viollet-le-Duc came in and redid all of that, but then more so, including this great spire that he built in the 19th century, which includes the 12 apostles on it, and including one that is Thomas, who's a patron of architects. And somebody made Thomas look a little bit like Viollet-le-Duc. Now, that's up in the spire. That's up in the air. And the goal of the architect of Notre Dame and the preservationist is to rebuild it the way it was, as close as possible, but taking into consideration some things. They may add some little steel plates here and there.
Yeah.
But it's a very fancy wooden building. In fact, one of the reasons to rebuild it the way it was is it's one of the early complex wooden roofs. Above the stone ceiling, a very complex wood roof that spans 50 feet and is very long and very tall. And then to have this tower sitting on top of that, this tower that weighed multiple tons, is a very technological feat. So to rebuild that is a good thing, to preserve that amazing technology,
yeah,
you
see.
Could say.
I see. Fair enough. Let's see if we can get one more in. Robert in Wichita, Kansas, listening on 96.7. You got to ask your question quickly if you'd like an answer.
Very good. It's wonderful to get to listen to the two of you gentlemen in this conversation. Duncan, I have a question. I'm just curious, how important is it to you, in your personal opinion, that all of the artists and artisans, craftsmen, are believers in order to be engaged in that work?
In the building of a church.
Space?
Okay.
Yes. So, of course, when we build a church, I think the last one that I did at Hillsdale College, somebody figured out, 500 people were involved, some crazy number of people were involved. So, and as the owner or the architect, you don't have control over the individuals. What we look for are contractors, subcontractors, artisans, and artists who are sympathetic to what we're doing and have the love of what we're doing, which is a traditional church, as well as who appreciate the tradition. They respect it. And that tends to be the people that work on our projects, and we're fortunate to have that. Now, when it comes to things like art, paintings, and sculpture, it makes a huge difference that not only are they willing to do what you want, which is a Madonna and child and multiple saints, but they believe in it, and they can find a way to express that even better than you could imagine.
Robert, thank you very much for the question. Thanks to everybody who called. Our guest has been Duncan Stroik from Notre Dame University. Thank you very much.
And of course, it doesn't matter at all about the architect. Just hire any architect you want.
And that's not right. I know that that's not true. And we got Jimmy Akin coming up. And where to go if they want to find out more about your work? Is there a website they can go to?
Well, there is a website at stroik.com. And I'd also love it if people would look at the sacredarchitecture.org, which is our magazine, sacredarchitecture.org, if you're interested in this subject.
All right. We'll be right back with Jimmy Akin, open forum, and maybe an 8-year-old caller right after this. Catholic Answers Live.